You're listening to The Murder in My Family, brought to you by Abjack Entertainment. Be sure to check out some of the other great true crime podcasts from this network, including Missing Persons,
DNA ID,
Scene of the Crime,
Zodiac Speaking,
Beyond Bizarre True Crime,
Citizen Detective,
and
Campus Killings.
All of these podcasts are available for you to binge on right now, wherever you listen to podcasts. Subscribe where you're listening to this podcast so you don't miss an episode.
The views and opinions expressed by guests on this podcast do not necessarily represent those of the podcast, its host, or sponsors.
If you would like to discuss the murder in your family on this podcast, please be sure to visit themurderinmyfamily.com for more information.
You can support this podcast by visiting patreon.com/themurderinmyfamily. This episode may contain unsettling material or subject matter. Listener discretion is advised.
Thank you for joining me for this episode of The Murder in My Family. I'm your host, Mike Morford. In this episode, we'll be discussing the case of a man who was killed in a hail of gunfire in a populated part of Baltimore. Yet somehow, no one in the area saw anything, at least that they're willing to talk about publicly, perhaps out of fear of retribution. Because of the lack of witnesses, the case remains open, and the victim's family continues to await answers that may never come. We'll dive into this case after some quick housekeeping. Independent podcasts like this one depend on word of mouth to bring in new listeners. So if you find that you enjoy this show, please take a moment to rate and review it wherever you listen to your podcast. And be sure to introduce a friend to the show and invite them to listen. With your help, The Murder of My Family can continue to grow and reach a new audience. To learn more about the show or the cases we discuss, please visit themurderofmyfamily.com. You can also find us on Twitter with the handle @MurderMyFam or on Facebook at facebook.com/TMIMFpodcast. If you'd like to support this show through a Patreon donation, it's always appreciated, and you can do so by visiting patreon.com/TheMurderMyFamily. Benefits of supporting the show on Patreon may include early access to ad-free episodes of the show, plus bonus content not heard in regular episodes. Support may also include thank you cards, stickers, and more. In each episode, I'll give shout-outs to any new supporters. And thank you to all of the supporters that generously donate to help keep the show growing and improving. One last note. Please support any of the sponsors that you hear on The Murder of My Family the way that those sponsors support the show. It's with our sponsor support that this show can go on and continue to provide a platform to share these stories with you in every episode. Thank you. And now on with the show. Stephen Timothy Sloman was born on March 16, 1966, to Alfred and Marlene Sloman. The youngest of four children, he was their only son. He spent most of his life in Carroll County, Maryland, and graduated from Westminster High School in 1984. He went on to study at Catonsville Community College, where he entered technical studies and learned about computer-aided design and drafting. He also went to Towson State University, where he studied geographic information systems. He went on to study cybersecurity at Carroll Community College and also University of Maryland College. He got into computers when not everyone knew how to use one, but Stephen was a wizard with computers. In the summer of 1987, he completed basic training at Fort Benning in Georgia, and he began his service with the National Guard 1st Battalion, 175th Infantry. He was commissioned as a second lieutenant. Stephen was able to attend officer training school, which not all members of the military are eligible to join. Due to his skills in cybersecurity, computer-aided design, and drafting, he was granted a government clearance and did cybersecurity work for the Department of Defense. And Stephen was a very proud veteran, but he was also a very proud father. He had three children, Asher, Aiden, and Emma, as well as many nieces and nephews and a grandchild. Stephen loved the beach and was into antiquing. He collected antiques of all kinds and was said to have been a historian at heart, with a particular fondness for Gettysburg. Stephen also loved the arts. He enjoyed writing to express himself and loved listening to music and watching movies. But despite work, family, and hobbies, Stephen fell into a deep depression around 2015 after experiencing a heartbreak. His family recalls that he was very much struggling with his demons since that time, while living in Finksburg, a little more than half an hour outside of Baltimore. Despite the rough patch Stephen was going through, he managed to keep going and wake up every morning to fight another day, until one day in October 2022. He woke up that day, and someone decided that he would not wake up the next. At 7:09 p.m. on October 13, 2022, officers responded to the 4800 block of Reisterstown Road in Baltimore, Maryland. Residents living in the area called and reported shots being fired. Police found 56-year-old Stephen Sloman in the driver's seat of a van in the area. A total of 27 shots had been fired at him. Seven struck his body, and he died at the scene. It was raining that evening, which unfortunately washed away a lot of potential evidence. Police contacted Stephen's sisters, who had been traveling at the time, and broke the news to them that their brother was dead. They then made what had to surely be a long and sad cross-country drive back to Maryland to tend to the aftermath of Stephen's death. Stephen Sloman was only one of three people killed in shootings in Baltimore in the same week. First, Stephen was killed on October 13th, then 23-year-old Antonio Wilkins on October 14th, and finally, Santos Munoz Hernandez on October 15th. There's no known connection between Stephen's murder and the other two murders that week, but it shows how sharply gun violence was increasing in the area at the time. In fact, there's so many murders connected to gun violence in Baltimore that many of them never get much attention from the press, and police seem to be fighting an uphill battle in solving some of these cases. 27 bullets seems pretty personal, and it certainly doesn't seem like a stray bullet or an accidental shooting. Whoever shot at Stephen seemed to be targeting him and wanted him dead. But why would a father of three, a veteran, end up dead 40 minutes from his home, where he was found? What brought him there? These are just some of the still unanswered questions in this case. That area has a lot of row houses and alleys, with lots of homes and residents packed into the area. It was only 7 p.m. when the shooting occurred, and people were close enough to hear gunshots being fired, which is why they called police. So this wasn't some desolate area in the middle of the night. There had to be witnesses. But perhaps any witnesses in the area that have information are afraid to come forward, worried about what might happen to them if they cooperate with police. No suspects in Stephen's murder have been named by police, and they haven't talked publicly about what evidence they collected or if any fingerprints were found at the scene. And any surveillance in the area hasn't led to an arrest. Someone has to know something. If you have information about the murder of Stephen Sloman, please contact detectives by calling 410-396-2100. If you want to stay anonymous, you can also call Metro Crime Stoppers at 866-7-LOCKUP, and you can give your information without revealing your identity. Anything will help, because police, as far as we know, have nothing to go on at this point, and it seems as if Stephen's family don't have much hope that the case will be resolved. I sat down with one of Stephen's sisters, Deborah, to discuss Stephen's senseless and tragic murder. That conversation is coming up in just a moment.
911, what's your emergency?
My wife fell asleep in the bathtub and I think she's dead.
In August 2008, Sarah Widmer, a healthy 24-year-old woman, is found dead in her bathtub just 4 months after marrying her husband, Ryan, the only person at home with Sarah that night. Suspicion quickly fell on Ryan, leading to his arrest and conviction for Sarah's murder. But could this have been a tragic accident? Ryan has adamantly maintained his innocence for the last 15 years. Now, two seasoned criminologists examine this very controversial conviction for the murder of his wife, Sarah.
This case is the one with the most unanswered questions.
Now we're looking for a murder attorney. Like, who do you even ask?
You know, when you go in there and sit in that chair, people are going to automatically think you're guilty just because of where you're sitting.
Is Ryan a murderer, or did something else happen in that bathroom? Listen to Direct Appeal Season 2, The Ryan Widmer Case, wherever you get your podcasts.
Hi, Deborah, and thank you for coming on the Murder My Family to discuss your brother Stephen's case with us.
Hi, Mike. It's good to be here. Thank you for having me.
I'm happy to have you here. Obviously, not under good circumstances. Your brother, Stephen, was killed in Baltimore, a victim of gun violence. Unfortunately, that city has a high crime problem, as is widely reported. And as we'll get into, I'm sure not a good track record all the time as far as dependability or reliability of policing. But before we get into all of that and sort of unpack that, can you tell us a little bit about Steve and himself and what was he like?
Steven was the youngest of four. He had three older sisters, so he was our youngest brother. And the last several years of his life were not the best years of his life. We had lost, he was married and divorced, living with my mom and in Carroll County, which is just, you know, I guess that's a little west of Baltimore City. And our mom passed last March, and so he was in transition because we sold the house. And so from June until October, he was transitioning from living with my mom to getting his own place. He was bright, handsome, funny, you know, just a great brother to have for a long time. And then things changed for him.
So he went through a little bit of a rough period in his life where he was trying to rebuild and come out of that and transition to the next chapter.
Yes, but I think he had lost hope. I don't think that the transition was ever going to happen. I think that he was what I'd like to call stuck in a cycle of rumination. And he had a bit of mental illness, I would say also.
Okay.
And maybe now, some addiction.
Okay. And unfortunately, a lot of people I talk to, that is something that they battle, something that they go through. It touches so many families now. So, and your brother, if I read correctly, was an IT whiz or worked in the IT field. Can you tell us a little bit about what he did?
Yeah, he started out in his younger days. He worked as a computer aided design. He also had gone on to obtain a pretty good security clearance with the government. So he was doing a lot of monitoring communications, possibly, is what I think he did with them. And then there were some things that happened with the marriage that ended up in him losing that clearance, or the clearance was suspended. And that was kind of like the beginning of the end for him. That was probably 2012, I think. Yeah. So, go ahead.
I was going to say just a real tough time for him. It sounds like, going through all that stuff.
Yes. Losing his wife and his children becoming estranged from him, that set off a downward spiral that he was never quite able to lift himself out of.
Yeah. And that's an unfortunate situation. And yeah, I'm curious, how long, this is an area just right outside of Baltimore City itself, how long, and you mentioned that he had lived with with your mom, how long had he been living there and how long had he been living in the area in general?
That's the home we grew up in. He was living with my mom in the home that we had for 62 years. Moved there when I was one, and he is 6 years younger than I am. He was 6 years younger than I am. So yeah, he spent his whole life in that area. He's not a stranger to the city or the county.
Okay. And obviously when you say Baltimore, you know, it's not all just city. I know some of it's a little bit more open and not as much of a population. It sounds like he lived in an outskirt of there. Obviously so a little bit more
definitely a more rural area.
Yeah.
That is getting built up, but yes, we grew up is a very rural area. Farming, Carroll County's known for its farming community, and but also being built up, so it, you know, there was a lot of I guess you could say it's become a bedroom community for the greater Baltimore DC area.
Okay. And about how far a drive is that from Baltimore City itself?
28 miles.
Okay. So about a half hour or so. And how frequently did Stephen go into the city?
Well, see, therein lies the mystery, because him and I had become estranged over the summer. And so I wasn't really sure what he was up to or why he was there that particular day. I have, you know, in my mind, I have suppositions as to why he was there. I do know that in the past, he used to like to buy and sell things and would go down to the pawn shops. You know, and I have an aunt that lives in Middle River, and, you know, he would go down to see her. And we have a friend down on Philadelphia Road who we used to take things down to. In fact, all summer long, last spring, about a year ago, I had been visiting that particular shop myself quite often because my mom was a collector. So I was, you know, I went down there like probably three or four times in a span of a month or so to sell things to this particular shop. So but for him more recently, I can't give you an accurate answer on that, how often he was. I do believe he was down there to try to sell a piece of jewelry that day, a watch.
Okay. Now, had you growing up in there and going into the city as much as you did, as much as Stephen did, had any of you ever experienced any threats or run into any brushes with crime in the past?
No, none. Nope.
Okay. So again, you mentioned you don't really know why he was there. But he went there that day. He wound up in the city that day. And this is October 2022. So literally just 6 months ago. Can you walk us through that day? What happened as far as what is known about Stephen's last day?
Yeah. My sister and I, we were on a trip out west, and we got a phone call early that morning that my brother had not returned a rented car, and they wanted us to get in touch with him. As I said before, I really hadn't been keeping in contact with him, but my sister had. So she called him, and she said, you know, Steve, they're considering it a stolen vehicle. And, you know, she said, you got to take that back. And he was upset. He felt like we had left him after our mom died, and kind of, you know, which was not the case. We had tried to help him as much as we could within reason, given the circumstances. So he just wasn't very happy that day. And he said, all right, I'm going to return it. I'm going to return it tonight. He had just recently purchased a vehicle that had broken down on I-795 the Sunday before. So he did not have that car in his possession. So after the phone call, my sister got a little upset and she tried to contact him, and she was going to send him some money to help, you know, to help him kind of like, you know, see a light. And he wasn't taking any of the calls. And then he sent her a text and said, in the text, he said, yeah, I'll return the car tonight. Have a nice life. That was the last any of us heard from him. And then the next thing we hear is we get a call Saturday morning, October 15th, from a detective in Baltimore.
And what was it this detective told you when you got that call?
Well, actually, before that, like about a half an hour before the call, I received a private message from a friend of ours in Maryland, and she said, are you okay? And I'm like, yes. You know, and I was kind of surprised that she's asking me that question. And finally, I just called her, and she goes, well, I heard some very disturbing news. I heard that your brother has been found murdered in Baltimore. And I, you know, I was like, oh, okay. You know, well, I was a little more dramatic than that. So evidently they had gone, the detective had gone to my parents' home, our family home that we had just sold in June. And because that was the last known address on his license. And the neighbor had shared this information with the other friend and, you know, thinking that the police had already contacted me. So then I get the phone call and he said, yeah, you know, Thursday evening, December 13th, we responded to gunshots fired at the 4800 block of Reisterstown Road and, you know, found your brother dead behind the wheel. 27 shots were fired. He took 27 shots were fired outside of the vehicle, into the vehicle, like sprayed across the front of the windshield. And he took 7 gunshot wounds. So and was pronounced dead at the scene.
Okay. So that had to be devastating to get that kind of news out of the blue.
Yeah. Yes. Yes. To say the least. Yeah.
I mean, how do you process that? How did you, I mean, I'm envisioning in my mind, you're probably the world just stopping for a second while you're gathering that information and processing it.
Right. Especially when you're over 1,000 miles from home. We were in Colorado and just happened to stop to get a cup of coffee. Like I said, we were on this cross country trip, and you know, for me, I immediately my mind is all over the place, thinking, you know, how did this happen? You know, what was going on? What was he doing down there? And my sister, just who really kind of took on the role of like a mom and a caretaker to my brother, you know, over the past several years. Well, she just was hysterical. So yeah, it was. It really took a few minutes, a long couple few minutes to kind of like come back down to earth and figure out, okay, what do we do now? And, you know, spent the next 5 days driving cross country to get back to Maryland to find out to lay him to rest and to find out all that we could as to what had happened.
Sure. I mean, that's only natural to want to get there and race there and hopefully have some answers. And I'm curious, when you did get there, did they have any answers? Did they have any information that they were able to share with you about it at all?
No, they had nothing. There was a family that had a motion censored camera, did not pick up any of the actual shooting that occurred. Someone said they saw a silver car leaving the scene, but basically there's nothing. They have nothing. They have nothing more today, because I call there once a month to the homicide department, than they did basically the day he was shot. Their phone records have not given them any information. Of course, his phone, he must have had it in his hand and held it up because his hands were shot and his phone was cracked from being shot. So they have not shared any. I'm like, give me the phone records. I'll figure out what happened. You know, but nothing on that phone that was retrieved from the phone gives them any clue as to who or what or why he was there.
Is that what they told you?
The only real clue is that's what they told me. They have not. Okay. They have not found any pertinent information from the phone records.
Okay. So there's no way to tell, you know, if he was there to meet up with someone, anything like that, or this was just a random encounter with a random person on the street?
That's what they're telling me. You know, of course, I have my own feelings, you know, and I have shared those with the detective. I said, this sounds either totally random, like maybe a gang, some kind of gang violence, or someone getting their stripes or whatever they call that. You know, I mean, 27 shots fired. It sounds like either random or retaliation to me.
And I was just going to say, if it was some kind of retaliation, I mean, can you think of anything your brother would have been involved in that would require him being shot 27 times?
Well, I mean, the only thing I can think of would be is that he had a drug dealer down there, possibly. But, you know, Carroll County has its own plenty of its own drugs, and there was no evidence whatsoever that he had drugs in his possession, or was there, or was using drugs. There's nothing obvious. You know, there's no evidence that's showing that or leading to that. That's all supposition on my part, you know, just from knowing my brother. So yeah, it's like we're in this void of information. You know, he had an Invictus watch in the car with him. And so, of course, maybe I know that he had a bunch of those watches at one time. He bought a bunch of them so that he could resell them because, you know, my dad was an antique dealer. We were kind of wheeler and dealer family, you know, buying, selling for fun, you know, a hobby, that sort of thing. So I thought possibly, you know, that's what he was doing, was down there to meet someone to sell the watch.
Was this watch still in the car?
Yes.
And how about his wallet? Okay, nothing, no wallet, that kind of stuff. Okay, and carjacking, you know, he's still in the car, this car's there, so you think carjacking is not the motivation. And just out of curiosity, that watch that was found, did it have a great value to it?
It was probably $1,000 watch, so maybe he could have got, you know, a couple hundred for it, resale.
Okay, so it had some kind of value.
Big, bulky watches. Yeah.
Okay. So he could have, if someone was just looking to take something of value, they could have taken that watch for sure.
Right. The police don't feel like anyone was in the vehicle with him.
Okay.
But of course it was raining that night, so they weren't really able to retrieve any fingerprints or whatever they retrieved, fibers, things like that. That's what they're telling me. That's consistently what I'm being told.
Now, do you feel, obviously you mentioned a few minutes ago that you're right exactly where you are today with the case, where you were when this first happened. Do you feel that the police just aren't doing their best, or do you feel that they just don't have anything to go on and it's hard to connect dots when there's nothing there to go on?
Well, as you said before, Baltimore is inundated with shootings and crimes. You know, a lot of gun violence going on down there every day, because I follow the Murder Inc. page now, which I don't know if is good or not. So I feel like that they are overwhelmed with gun violence in Baltimore, that the police department is. I feel like they reached out to the neighborhood, but I don't feel like they pushed. I feel like nobody's going to come forward for a 56-year-old white male who's from Carroll County down in the city. That's not worth them taking a chance on their own lives to bring forth any information voluntarily, anonymously. I just don't think people care. You know, somebody saw something, in my opinion, and I feel like they're just not giving it up.
Yeah. And maybe, you know, perhaps because they are afraid of retaliation, that kind of thing, maybe?
Yes. Yeah. More than likely. It's not a good neighborhood. From what I've been told, I've talked to people who know about that area of Baltimore, and they're like, yeah, what was he doing down there? You know, it's like we have people down there and we don't even go to that area. Kind of between Pimlico and Mount Dolman, I guess. It's not a good area. I personally did not. I used to live near Pimlico many, many years ago, but, you know, as much as I wanted to go drive by where the incident took place, I did not.
And do you think, but, you maybe, know, kind of, I'm sorry?
That's okay. Go ahead.
I was going to say, do you think that the police maybe sort of brushed off the importance of the case because they just figure, okay, he's down in this bad area for purposes that are no good. And he's, you know, as opposed to someone, you know, upscale person that was, you know, in a better part of town, Do you think some of that comes into play, that maybe they don't put as much importance on him as a victim because they thought maybe he was up to no good down in that area?
Possibly. Yeah, possibly. I mean, they can't, you know, there's nothing that helps them to know him as a person except for what I've told them, which is a lot of the same things that I've told you. I tried, you know, I'm very honest and forthright about the situation and the situation that he was in. But nonetheless, you know, 27 shots were fired. This didn't even make the evening news. I have a friend that lives down, you know, right off of York Road, and he's like, I've heard nothing about this. This just wasn't like, you know, somebody came along and held him up and shot him. They fired 27 shots, and 25 of them were consistent with one gun, coming from one gun. So that means there was probably a reload, correct?
Yeah, I would think so, unless it was some kind of, you know, submachine gun or something like that.
Nine millimeter is what I said, yeah.
I know there are, you know, again, I'm no gun expert, but I know there are ways to modify guns so that they can be fired almost like a machine gun sort of, and fire more rounds than they're meant to fire. So, again, it's possible it was a reload, or it could have been modified to shoot sort of like a machine gun. But either way, that's a lot of shots. And you would think with that many shots, it's going to get people looking, and there would be some witnesses. But even with, you mentioned that somebody had a surveillance camera that didn't pick up anything. It's just hard to believe that there's no, because every street light seems to have some kind of camera on it, and stores have cameras in the windows and stuff like that. Especially if it's in a high crime area, you think people will have surveillance on and video cameras and stuff. And I'm just surprised that nothing, as far as we know, at least, was picked up on any of that.
Right. Well, the camera that the family had was motion censored. So they, like I said, they did have a frame of someone walking across the street. And I think I do believe the police said they may have seen that he had circled the block once. My understanding, it is more of a residential area with a park nearby, just by, you know, the Google Maps that I've looked at. So if there was any kind of closed circuit TV provided by the city, it wasn't working in that area.
And it seems like such a uphill battle too, because just sort of so much crime going on there. I mean, I'm looking now, cities with most murders 2023, Baltimore is number two behind St. Louis. So certainly inundated with that kind of crime. So just even starting to try and investigate it, people aren't willing to talk. I can imagine that sort of has hamstrung police trying to solve it, even if they want to put their best effort in. Where do you start? And with that much crime going on, it seems like your brother's case could easily get lost in the shuffle.
Yeah. And when I asked them about that, and like, when does something become a cold case? And, you know, well, they assure me that tips come in, you know, maybe someone will come in an unrelated case, but have some information, and they'll disclose that information at that time, that sort of thing. But yeah, I think this is clearly, there's just, without a witness basically without a witness, there's nothing, they can't move forward, really. There's nothing else to investigate.
Yeah.
Except for what happened at that time.
Yeah. Yeah. So barring a witness coming forward, like you mentioned, some other piece of evidence coming out of the blue, then it seems like a real uphill battle. Are you holding out hope? Or, I mean, how hopeful are you at this point that the case will be solved? Are you pretty much giving up hope?
I honestly feel like we'll never know what happened. I'll always, you know, maintain some level of hope that sometime something might be we might find anything out. None of that will ever bring him back. You know, there's nothing I can't go march down the streets of Baltimore, justice for Stephen or anything like that. You know, I mean, there's none of that. So I feel very helpless in that respect, that there's nothing that I can do but to help further or increase, you know, the level of awareness for investigation. But yeah, pretty much my sisters and I, we've kind of come to the conclusion that we'll probably never know what happened.
It's got to be a very helpless or frustrating feeling getting to that point.
Yes, it is. It is. We feel very helpless and very frustrated and very heartbroken.
But perhaps, you never know, maybe someone down the line, maybe to get out of a crime they're involved in, will spill the beans about someone else, information they have about the person that did this. You never know, someone trying to get out of their own, you know, trouble could, you know, spill the beans. Or maybe someone goes to jail and then all of a sudden somebody feels safer about talking. So there is that hope that down the line something changes, that somebody does come forward and share something. I was curious, because I didn't find it online, there wasn't a whole lot, as you mentioned. Was there any kind of reward being offered? Because sometimes that motivates people.
Yes, Crime Stoppers did offer, and we offered to double what they were offering, but the detective never returned. He didn't follow up on that with me, and I didn't really push it because there was just so much going on at the time. And I don't live in Baltimore, so it's not like I can go, you know, knock on a police station's door every other week. But Crime Stoppers, they put something up on Murder, Inc. It's an Instagram page.
Okay.
You know, that gives you the daily details of all the violence in Baltimore.
Well, we'll definitely do our part to share the case and put the information out there and let people know that, you know, this case is still one of many, unfortunately, in that area that are unsolved and need some kind of help being solved. Is there any kind of social media pages or websites or anything set up about the case?
No.
Okay.
No, I didn't do that.
Well, at the very least, we can pass out the police contact information, tip lines, things like that, mention the reward, and hopefully it gets in front of the right person and they're able to come forward with that missing piece of information that might help solve the case. But, you know, as we wrap up, I just want to ask you, so looking back, when you remember your brother, what is it that you want other people to know about him and the takeaway when they think about him?
He loved his kids. You know, he was, like I said, he was smart, he was funny, and he loved his children. And, you know, let his story be one. If somebody needs help, help them any way you can, I suppose. You know, I felt like that we did all we could do to help, but, you know, don't give up.
Yeah, definitely good advice. And hopefully you don't give up. Hopefully you do hold out hope. And down the line, at some point, you do get a call from the police with information, maybe saying that the case is finally cracked, and that will be a ray of light there, that there's justice finally. I hope you do get that. But in the meantime, I do appreciate you coming on and sharing Stephen's story with us.
Thank you, Mike.
Thank you once again for joining me for this episode of The Murder of My Family. I'd like to thank Sonny Landon for writing and research assistance in this episode. We'll be back here soon with an all-new episode of The Murder of My Family, and I hope you'll join me for it. But before you go, remember that every murder victim means something to somebody.